Hello and welcome to The Stream. I'm Josh Rushing. Today, Colombia and the dangerous job of being a human rights activist in that country. Now, what you're seeing here, these are the top five countries where human rights activists and social leaders were killed last year. Look at Colombia. It's at the top, 186 killed. That's according to the latest report from the rights group Frontline Defenders. So in today's episode, we look at the reasons why Colombia is the world's deadliest country for those wanting to protect human rights and what's being done about it. Joining us from Bogota, Laura Bonilla, Deputy Director of the Perez Foundation. That's a Latin American think tank specializing in conflict analysis. Also in Bogota, Inigo Alexander. He's a Colombia-based journalist covering human rights and social justice. And in Dublin, Ireland, Sarah DeRoor, Global Head of Protection for the rights group Frontline Defenders. And as always, you're also at the table. If you're watching this on YouTube, check it out. We have a live stream producer waiting there to get your comments to me so I can get them to our guest today. And you and I, well, we can do this thing together, right? All right, let's begin with Laura. Why is it so dangerous to be a human rights defender in Colombia, of all places?
Well, basically, the short answer is because our long war history and our long-term armed conflict. To be a little bit more clear for the audience, Colombia have a long-term conflict for so many years, and each 10, 15, 20 years, we try to do a peace process. And our last peace process was failed in the implementation of the peace agreement, and that creates like the sensation and the feeling in the armed group that the Colombian state cannot accomplish basically with nothing. And also that creates a lot of frustration in the field. And at the same time, during the past 5 years, the public forces was not really present in the field. And that implies that many armed groups, any kind of armed groups, are starting to grow up in the, especially in the rural area, especially in certain areas. So for that kind of armed groups, the social leadership are the enemy. Why? Because all those armed groups are living from the violence. They are like violent producers, and they are in certain way selling the violence. So a social leader, a human rights defenders, usually try to stop that actions from armed groups, try to speak loud about the territorial control of the violence or certain things. So that's why right now for that type of violence, you know, the situation in Colombia is so dramatic for human rights defenders and also for social leaders. And something that I think that is really important is that Colombia is very generous with the categorization. So for us, usually the social leaders and the human rights defenders used to be the same person in the field. So maybe also for that reason, we have, 186 cases.
Well, speaking of 186 cases there, I actually want to put a face on some of those names rather than just being numbers. So, Sarah, you're part of Frontline Defenders. We've gone to your website here. And, just looking at it's broken down by country. You look at Colombia and look at these faces. Attempted killing, new death threat, killed. Let's go in on this one here. Teofilo Acuña. What can you tell us about him? Why was he killed?
Yeah, thank you, Josh, for bringing Teofilo into this conversation. And definitely, I think when we have numbers more than reporting a number of cases, we want to bring the memory of those who were killed and tell a story of why they were killed. So in the case of Teofilo Acuña, he was actually killed together with another defender, Jorge Alberto, and they were killed in February last year. The two of them were campesinos leaders. Sometimes in English, not the best wording, because then people use peasants. Yeah, but in the context of Latin America, campesino is what translates better the kind of community role that they are looking at. So they were two defenders advocating for land rights, advocating for the rights of campesinos to be way to sustain their, to have the conditions to sustain their livelihood. And both of them, I think this is an emblematic case, because Teófilo and Jorge, they actually came up with public denouncements about the death threats that they were being subjected to. And only 2 days before they were killed, there was, again, a public denounce on the death threats that they were being subjected to because of the denounces they were making against the role of the municipality and the local police. So the two of them were actually shot dead in front of their family. And until today, we don't have a response of who were actually responsible for that particular case. I think this is an emblematic case because it shows that those individuals are not only isolated individuals, but they represent collective struggles, as Laura was saying, in the context of Colombia, how important it is as part of a community defense, as part of community organized. And I think in the case of Teófilo, again, it also shows the pattern of the criminalization of human rights defenders in the case of Colombia. So Teófilo was actually detained in 2020, and that shows a story like he was detained, he received a death threat, and then finally he was killed, which I think for us as an organization evidenced the lack of effective protection for human rights defenders at risk in that context.
And then another case that we wanted to look into, Inigo, can you tell us about this 14-year-old boy who was killed in Cauca?
Yeah, that case was one that really struck a chord, in particular last year. It took place early on in the year in January, right at the start of the year. He was one of the first few human rights defenders, and in his particular case, environmental defender, who was murdered. And the striking thing about the case is his age. He was just 14. And he was shot dead in the region of Cauca, which is in the southwest of the country. And he was murdered when he was taking part in sort of a traditional a patrol of a lot of the indigenous territories, which he lived in. He was part of the Indigenous Guard, which is sort of pan-national organization. It's an unarmed group, and they tasked themselves with trying to protect their own territories and trying to defend their communities and their causes from potential threats and risk, as a lot of those indigenous communities do live in areas of the country which are have a heavy presence of armed groups and, as a consequence, suffer quite a lot of intimidation and violence. And he was unfortunately killed when they were ambushed. His patrol was ambushed, him, and he was going along with his father, who I believe survived, but another member of the patrol was also killed. And they just faced open fire in a small rural area of Cauca when they were just trying to patrol and provide a minimum degree of protection and security to vulnerable communities. They'd heard that there was an alleged presence of armed groups in their community. So the patrol went down to try and see what was going on and just try and see if they could calm down the situation or at least provide some degree of protection to the communities. And as a result, they just got shot at, and young Brainerd unfortunately got killed. And it just goes to show a lot of the killings are they're just unbridled, untargeted attacks that just take lives of innocent people, like Brainerd, who was just 14-year-old, who was just taking part of his usual patrol and trying to defend his community and trying to also as well defend the environment. And as a result of being part of that patrol in that community, he was unfortunately murdered. So that was a case that in particular really did strike a chord last year.
I just want to make clear, because we're talking about him patrolling to defend his community. I want our audience to understand they were not armed. It was just basically their presence there, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry to jump, but this is important. Yes. Sorry, Nico. Go on.
Yes, I was just saying the Indigenous Guard is as Josh was saying, not an armed group. They're an unarmed Pacific group, and they just patrol the areas just to provide sort of the minimum level of safety and security from those threats, which, as I mentioned before, in a lot of the indigenous areas, armed groups have quite a heavy presence.
Right, right.
So just the presence of unarmed, rather, indigenous patrols.
Hey, guys,
to try and deter that.
I want to bring in some reporting. This is done by my friend and colleague, Alessandro Rampietti, who's down in Bogota, reports from Colombia for Al Jazeera English on our news side. And he interviewed Oscar Sampaio, who's an environmental activist from there. And I want to share this piece of video.
Oscar told us that he's been threatened by criminals he claims are responsible for dumping toxic waste in agricultural or protected areas near the city of Barranca Bermeja. The government has provided him with a daytime bodyguard, a flat jacket, and a panic button. But he says the security measures are no match for the armed groups who operate with impunity.
We are scared. And the government institutions that should be our recourse, like the Regional Attorney General, the Inspector General, the Ombudsman, often look the other way because they have been co-opted by the criminal groups.
All right, Laura, there's a couple things I want to touch on there. I eventually want to move to impunity. Which has brought up the idea of it. But even before that, I think it was in your pre-interview, you told us something along the lines that the violence is the economy.
Yes.
Can you explain that hypothesis?
Yes. So many people, especially, you know, I used to work with a Swedish organization for so many years, and most of the people outside Colombia believe that this is an issue, about narcos or different illegal economies, and the solution to all of that is just to, you know, end or fight the illegal economies of the criminal economies. The point here is that we don't have the same conflict that another countries with narcos with their own armies, maybe in the past. But right now we have the narcos in one place, and we have armed groups selling the violent services. So basically all the groups, guerrillas, paramilitaries, private army groups, are selling like a service of violence and protection. So I personally know Sampaio, my colleague, and I am from the same region. So What is the point with that? This is a very good case to explain that. Mm-hmm. The social leaders and the environmental leaders are against, you know, some kind of contamination. So people who are contaminating, they are not taking, you know, direct actions against the leaders. They hire some group or they give money to some group. And that group, for instance, in that region, this is a petroleum region, that group doesn't need to move narcotics in any place of the country or outside the country. For them, it's more easy to go to the legal economy of petroleum, or legal economy of any kind of oil and energy, and try to extract the resources for that economy. And if you just finish the narcotraffic, right now we are in a high crisis, in a high economic crisis. Narcotraffic is not now a good business in Colombia. So, you know, people are suffering in the field. You know, they don't have anything to buy the coca, the crops. So why is still the violence? Because the same groups that, you know, that before of this crisis, they were buying things and they were buying the coca leaves, and that the same groups are trying to increase their rents, you know, using the extortion. And that explain a little bit why for these groups are just the territorial control. You know, the territorial control is the key of this new conflict in Colombia and in general in Latin America.
Well, I want to bring in some voices from YouTube who are watching the show right now. This is from YouTuber Man. Says drugs is the most important problem in Colombia. And then, okay, whatever, that's their name, not mine, says, I'm wondering to what extent do people there know about the idea of human rights? It seems at least they know there's a concept of human rights before, therefore they have so many activists standing up. And then there was one about impunity. And, oh, is this because there are no effective state institutions? That's from Brian Filter. Now, we're going to answer these questions. But first, I want to bring in one more video comment from our community. This is from Andrew Miller. He's the advocacy director at Amazon Watch.
The Petro administration has placed human rights defenders in very important positions of influence. For example, the Vice President, Francia Marquez, also the Peace Commissioner, Danilo Rueda, among others. Those individuals, however, are facing entrenched systems of impunity. For example, the Fiscal General, Colombia's Attorney General, Francisco Barbosa, has not demonstrated the political will to investigate and hold accountable government officials responsible for human rights violations. One example is the Alto Romanzo massacre from last year, in which Colombian counter-narcotics units killed 11 people, including community leaders and a Quechua indigenous governor. To date, an investigation has not been carried out and officials have not been held accountable.
Iñigo, why aren't people being held to account for these murders?
Yeah, that's a long-standing issue that Colombia's had, the rampant impunity and the state inefficiency in this regard. A lot of it is down to the fact that, at least I believe, the armed groups that are oftentimes carrying out these killings, they know they can get away with them. They know that they're operating in areas where they are basically the de facto government, and they can do as they please, especially in terms of dealing with any opposition voices or any resistance to any of their illicit economies. So there has been a long history of state impunity. And I just wanted to bring up a point that Alessandro Rampietti mentioned in the video, which is the state protection system. They have a national protection unit as part of the Ministry of Interior here in Colombia, which provides protection to people under threat, people who are perceived, under perceived harm. But that's basically the sort of the go-to mechanism, and it's not a particularly effective one. Last year was given a budget of just over $1 million, I believe, which in the grand scheme of things is not a lot. And it's also a very inefficient, a very slow process. I've spoken to a number of defenders who are allegedly protected under that program, but have waited for months and months and months and months to receive their protection. And the protection is fairly minimal in the grand scheme of things. Again, like you mentioned in the video, maybe a stab-proof vest, maybe a driver, which might not do.
Yeah, I think building on what Diego had evidenced, we have actually dealt with cases in which people were threatened by those who were supposed to be protecting them in the program. So it means the program has a number of limitations. And I think in the context of Colombia, it's really important to think, to identify exactly who are those defenders who have been killed. When we look at this number of 186 cases, are the cases have been collectively verified. And in the case of Colombia, a very important partner organization, which is Somos Defensores, come up with the numbers and the breakdown. So when we open those numbers, who are we looking at? We are looking at 42% of them are indigenous people. And we are looking at 72 out of those 186 cases were people involved on the juntas comunales, which means people who actually took up a leadership role in a very, very local level. So people who are involved on community organizing, on land rights, which is evidencing the fact that those protection mechanisms don't reach those most isolated communities, which means the protection mechanisms are not accessible where they are most needed at. So you can still access it, but it's not everywhere. It's not consistent across the country. So I think you could flag it correctly, and I'm sure Laura also has been working.
When you're talking about the ineffectiveness of this protection system, I want you to know we reached out for video comments from Colombia, and some of the people were really too scared to put their face on camera. So we have this comment. This is from Juan Jose Guzman. He's a climate justice activist in New York City.
I come forward to you on behalf of a community I'm very fond of in northern Colombia. They have chosen not to show their faces because they feel threatened by armed groups in the region. These armed groups are establishing new territorial control over disputed lands between peasants, indigenous communities, and tourist developments in northern Colombia. These armed groups are not only enticing violence, but seek to control this land to be able to carry weapons, to traffic drugs, and to be able to exploit natural resources such as land, wood, and mines. Local communities have come forward to the government asking for support and for help. Local authorities fear these armed groups, and the central Colombian government has so far remained silent.
Laura, what can be done? What should be done?
Yeah, well, this will be, maybe this will sound simple, but it's not simple to do that. But no, first, the impunity has a lot to do with our centralism. So people in danger cannot use the local authorities to protect themselves. So they have to call to Bogota, they have to look for NGOs, they have to look for another institutions to help them to get protection that they need. In the second place, people, for instance, you are talking about Cauca. Cauca is the most dramatic situation right now for indigenous people, especially for women. So women, indigenous women in Cauca, if they want to implement a collective road of protection, they need to go to Bogota because the local state don't have the capacity or the interest to do something, you know, really effective. And that could take a lot of time because our bureaucracy and also because our corruption. Corruption is close connected with violence in Colombia. And this is really important because it's like we think, okay, the institutions, but recently the UNP, Unidad Nacional para Protección, that institution did a death threat against, a death attack, against the director. So the director tried to control the corruption within the institution, and he received a death attack.
Wow.
So this is the level of, you know, President Petro have a very good will about human rights defenders, but the government needs to understand that if we don't build a local capacity for civil society and for the local state, we are not doing something really effective. And the second point is the impunity, of course. Of course, impunity is something that increases the dramatism of the situation. But if the armed groups want to keep the territorial control, it will be very difficult to have another, you know, solution.
We're starting
drama.
To run low on time, and I also want to look at maybe what the international community should be aware of in this situation. So I want to bring in a video comment. This is from Shruti Suresh. She's a Land and Environment Defenders Campaign. She's the lead for Global Witness.
The Colombian government must now turn commitments into action. Global Witness analysis has found that Colombia is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for environmental defenders. Our NGO partner, Somos Defensores, has this week reported that the families of over 1,300 defenders killed in the country are still waiting for justice. We need urgent action from the government to end this culture of impunity, which is fueling further violence against defenders. We also need the US, EU, and other countries in the global north to ensure that their private sector businesses in Colombia do not contribute to human rights abuses faced by defenders.
So, Sarah, I also want to bring in a comment from YouTube here. This is from Kyle Marston, says, whatever aid the United States provides needs to stop involving handing out munitions and firearms. And I noticed in that last video comment, she talked about the global north needs to be aware of contributing to the situation. Can you talk from an international perspective of what the international community needs to do here to support Colombia?
No, definitely. I think if there is definitely an aspect engaged, that's the role of the business and the private sector, they might not be directly engaged on the violence acts, but the truth is their business are being benefited by the fact that defenders are those standing on the ways for the implementation of extractive or large extractive big projects in Colombia. So those businesses have benefit for the fact that those defenders have been taken out of the way, have been forced displaced from their communities. I think in the case of Colombia, if there is a civil society who has developed deep knowledge and deep political understanding of the issues of protection, is the civil society in Colombia. So I don't think we have knowledge to offer. What we have to offer is solidarity, is support to sustain the livelihoods of those communities, because ultimately those human rights defenders are advocating and being killed for defending the ways of living for different communities. So I think what the international community has to do in the end of the day is to support the livelihoods of those communities and, of course, advocate and support their networks for better protection. And I think if impunity is definitely a massive issue on the challenge of protection. We have to add the absence of the state in the different parts of the country and also the critical role that human rights defenders are playing still in the absence of the country, the state, for the implementation of the peace agreement. the fact that defenders are putting themselves in the front line of the peace agreement, the fact that human rights defenders and communities are taking up the role to implement the peace that's so important for them means that they are putting themselves at risk.
Sarah, this is it. This is the final seconds of the show. Thank you so much for those final words on this. We'll keep watching this story here at Al Jazeera English. You can always find us at stream.aljazeera.com. Thanks for watching.